accessible through the computer. I think we better pick up Paul. He may have fallen asleep. I wonder if he got my email I sent him this week. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
And a quick break. Did I get the email too? Because I just got home a few minutes before going on the air from a long trip with these radio control model airplanes. My son and I have got a tradition for the last 7 or 8 years that we go to this 3-day show. Well, it's actually a 1-week show, but we catch 3 days of it. So is there an email that I should have read also, John, KC2WGB, K2LAW?
I think you did read it. That was the one about the comets. I think I sent a copy of the comet email to Paul also. I believe that's what I sent them.
This is the one which is talking about the charge of the comets or whether they contain water. Give me a couple of words now.
Exactly. It was labeled, I believe, the electric comet. And, yeah, the question of there is no water on most of them. And it's a pseudo-deposition of water in the coma. So I know you read it. I think it was 50 minutes or 70 minutes, something like that. You did say it was interesting.
It's slowly coming back. I've got to open up another book mentally here. I've got to close one and open up the other one. Paul, WS2N, what's NASA been doing? That new spacecraft that they launched toward the moon, how's it doing? I think it had a little bit of problem with its inertial reel at one time. WS2N, let's see how well you're copying tonight, Paul. K2LIW.
K2LIW, WS2N. And, yeah, John, as of 2 days ago, that was the last time I looked at the email. I didn't look at it tonight. But I will look. The Lottie moon mission, that's doing good. The reaction wheel problem was solved. They said about 4 or 5 hours after it was detected by the engineers, so they straightened that out by changing the limits on the amperage. And apparently that was okay. They left it alone. They're not going to worry about it. And that's working. So in 30 days, it will reach the moon. And then we'll have a 60-day mission around the moon. It's going to go into a polar orbit. Right now it's in a very extreme elliptical orbit. And first of all, how's my signal there?
Your signal sounds very good, Paul. And I am hearing that latency. I know you're coming through the eastern input. It's working very well. So, yes, I do remember now that we had quite a discussion last week. Because Laddie was having this problem with its inertial wheel, and by some magic, the inertial wheels used on the Voyager, which is now 35 years out, 120 or so astronomical units away, and those, in theory, those inertial wheels have been cranking all of this time, essentially without failure, from all we can tell. So whatever brand name those inertial wheels are, NASA's got to use them more often, or maybe we were just lucky in that particular mission. But there's Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, and they both don't have inertial wheel problems. It's too good to be true. What's going on there? Please line up, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay, very good. Yeah, and the inertial wheels on Voyager, I don't know if they're operating all the time, if they come on, come off. I think they probably will. If they want to change the attitude, they'll do that. Yeah. The Lottie mission is extremely elliptical. It's actually in orbit around the Earth right now. It goes out to like 116,000 miles and then comes back very close to the Earth. And then when it's behind the Earth, it'll light the engine one more time and then it'll go into a higher elliptical orbit. And right now it takes 13 hours. Was it 13? Was it 13 hours or 13 days? Some ridiculous number. I think it's I think it was 13 hours to make one revolution. and then another 13 hours, make another revolution, and then I think after three revolutions, which is about 30 days from now, it will be caught into a 13-day orbit. It's got 160,000 miles. But whatever, after three orbits of the Earth, it will be close enough to the Moon where the Moon's gravitational pull will pull it in, and it will go into a polar orbit. But that's the system that they're using. Instead of a direct shot like, well, most of the lunar missions, including Apollo, where you go like three or four days out to get to the Moon. It's not one of those deals. I wanted to talk about comets. The Deep Impact mission launched in 2005 has come to pretty much an end. Looks like a software problem. Computer keeps booting and rebooting. You might remember this is the mission that went out to Temple 1. And after 6 months of launch from the beginning of 2005, it had an impactor on it. It's a big, heavy, 800-pound copper impactor that separated from the mothership and hit the comet. A bunch of dust and everything came up, created its own little crater. It was blinded by the dust. Deep Impact was trying to take pictures, and it didn't do all that good, but there were a lot of telescopes pointing to it at the time on Earth and in space, and they did get some results. So it was only supposed to be a 6-month mission, but after that they gave it an extended mission and went out to another comet and then to another one, and as of last year was taking pictures of this ISON comet that's going to be coming in November. So Deep Impact lost contact. The antenna is probably not pointing toward Earth. The rebooting problem was going over and over again, and they've lost all telemetry as of August. But it was a good mission. But again, a half a year mission turned into an 8-year mission. Let me drop it. It's WS2N. So, just wanted to, I know we covered that mission from launch. It took off on a Delta 2 rocket with a bunch of, I think it had a half a dozen solid boosters attached to it. So, now that's not one of these ion things. A couple of the other missions. But, it's a regular mission designed for one purpose. They've gotten a lot more science out of it than it was originally proven. Dawn is the other one that's going out to the asteroids. But this was a comet type of deal. You know, you had other missions like Stardust that went out to a comet, brought materials back in a tennis racket type of gadget with aerogel in it, but you had never had one actually impact a comet, and that's what a Deep Impact did. You mentioned Voyager. We'll talk about that in a second. I just wanted to go over a couple of missions that have been delayed. Falcon 9 1.1 mission out of Vandenberg, California, which was supposed to go off beginning of the month, is now being delayed two or three different times, and now it's up to the 29th or 30th of this month. And that's the one that's going to launch the Canadian Cassiopeia spacecraft. But I'm more interested in the Falcon 9. It's a redesign of Dragon, SpaceX. SpaceX makes the Falcon 9 and the Dragon. Dragon isn't going up this time. That's the spacecraft. The rocket is, but it's completely redesigned. It's a 9-stage rocket. but instead of having them in a row, you have one in the middle and you have eight surrounding it. But not only that, they've extended the tanks, so the rocket is about 60% taller than the other ones that have flown to the International Space Station. But this is the configuration that they'll be using in the future, next time it goes up to the ISS at the beginning of next year, and another private mission from Florida. They're going to be using the same rocket, and this is the one that they plan on eventually, this design, bringing back and landing on a launch pad. They plan on landing it vertically, and they're actually going to test it with this particular rocket after it separates from the Cassiopeia spacecraft. It's going to ignite its rockets one time, and it's going to slow it down 4,000 miles an hour to a much lower speed, and then they're going to launch the ignite the rocket one more time as it gets closer to the water to try to duplicate landing up. And we're going to see how that works out. And it's only the center rocket that's doing that. And that's the reason they have the Grasshopper rocket. Grasshopper rocket is an actual 100-foot rocket. One engine that they've been playing around with. SpaceX has launched it a couple hundred feet and boarded back and landed it right on the exact spot it took off. Couple of times now, so they're getting there with that technology. Let me drop it. Another mission going up in the couple of days, actually, let's say Sunday, it would be Monday, Tuesday, probably Wednesday, is the Antares Cygnus mission. The Antares is the new rocket built by Orbital Science. Cygnus is also a new spacecraft that they had built. And that will be going to the International Space Station with 1,300 pounds worth of supply. The first time for this private corporation to do it. I know SpaceX has done it three times. This will be the first time for them. And good luck to them. They've got plenty of years in the space business, space launching business. They're the ones that do Pegasus rockets. And they're the ones that just launched the Minotaur 5. With the Lottie lunar rocket last week. So it's being launched from the same spacecraft, site in Virginia, Wallop Island, Virginia. And if you go down near the shore, you'll be able to see it go off, even on Long Island, go down to, let's say, Jones Beach. About 15 degrees above the horizon is what you would see. You would see, look like, I guess, a star going up 10, 15 degrees above the horizon, and then it would drop down again. And they said you could easily see the last one that went off, the Minotaur 5 rocket. And, of course, I wanted to talk about Voyager. It was in the news. Probably every news station did have it on last week. That the scientists have come to the determination that Voyager has passed the edge of what we consider the solar system. It has gone through the heliopause, and as of actually last year, so probably about 3 AU back in August. But it took them all this time to make the decision that the data that they had was correct. Ed Stone even gave an interview. He was in charge of the project when it launched back in 1977. So Voyager 1 traveling north of the ecliptic, and Voyager 2 going south of the ecliptic. Voyager 1 being further out, traveling about 40,000 miles per hour away from the sun. Still doing its job with its plutonium on board. Started out around 400 watts of power. And I'm sure that's down quite a bit. They did say that the transmitting power coming from Voyager was 23 watts, Dick. And I have a question about that because the bit rate is 160 bits per minute. We've talked about this before. And it's roughly 8.2 gig, I think, is what they're transmitting at. So in a couple of minutes, maybe you could explain how come that rate drops so much the further they go out. You know, I mean, the signal's still being received at the same frequency. It's very, very weak because inverse square law and all, but I don't know, for some reason the distance changes everything with the bit rate, 160 bits per second. That's how they get all their data from Voyager. No more pictures or anything, everything's shut down, but they're getting information from all the detectors to figure out where the plasma is in deep space and which direction it's coming from. And by knowing that, they know the difference between the galactic plasma and the solar plasma. So, interesting thing. We talked about the tracking of a void last week, too. And they do have two types of tracking. One is a star track setup. It looks at usually one particular star, and it tries to keep that in its sight. And that gives it like a Z-axis type thing. And then there's another one that they have is a sun tracking device, which I guess it's a photo receiver, looking at the light. The idea of that is to point back to the sun. Well, since this spacecraft always wants to point roughly back to Earth, this detector looks at the sun. To do that, there's a little hole. They have a hole in the dish, this parabolic dish, this 14-foot diameter thing. That's how big their dish is. This hole was put there so that this detector could see the sun. And then they of course, had the reaction wheels to move it around. They want to change its location in space. Another way they could tell the way it's facing or where it is in the universe is by the radio signals. They detect the frequency and the Doppler shift and all, and they could actually tell also if the spacecraft is kicked one way or the other. That's pretty much it for the space report. This is WS2N, and my email, let me drop it, is space report, SpaceNet, I'm sorry, spacenetreport@gmail.com. And John, I'll look into the email later. Back to you there, Dick. Are we running out of time? This is WS2N.
KC2YDT with the query.
Yeah, Paul, let me know if you got it, because I may have sent it to the wrong email. I think that's the email I sent it to. Yeah, just let me know. KC2WGB.
That recognize will get you in a second. You said two things with reference to Voyager. A whole bunch of things. That apparently it is now just about confirmed that it has confirmed that it has left the solar system. It's now into the galactic system as far as is looking at galactic wind instead of solar wind as the dominant stuff it's looking at, is my understanding. But when it comes to the bit rate, you said 160 bits per minute, and then you said 160 bits per second. Before I proceed, which one do you think it is, Paul? Bits per minute, 160, or bits per second? WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick, I copy. I gotta listen to Glenn Oaks here to hear you. 160 per second, I'm sorry. Per second.
Okay, that makes more sense. 160 bits per minute would be less than 3 bits per second. I know it got slow, but I didn't think it got that slow. But to answer your question, a 8.2 gig dish, which is called KU band, I call it lower KU band, but it's KU band, and a 14-foot diameter dish. That combination of frequency and dish size gives you 49 decibels of gain. That's all a lot of gain. And it gives you 6/10 of a degree of total beam width. So if you aimed with an accuracy of plus or minus 3/10 of 1 degree of error in aiming that dish at the Earth, you would already be 3 dB down, half power. So to really get that signal from that dish with 0.6 degree beamlet aimed at the Earth with the highest possible gain, I'll bet you they're trying to get to something like plus or minus 0.1 degree of accuracy. So by way of the star tracking, sun tracking, inertial wheels, and whatever, you're looking for approximately 0.1 degree of accuracy in azimuth elevation in aiming that dish at the Earth. Let me drop. Now, one of the things that's not so clear to some people is that listening to a weak signal, how weak is the signal going to be coming into your receiver? By way of the inverse square law, in other words, every time you double the distance, the amount of signal you get becomes 4 to 1 weaker, 6 decibels weaker every time you double distance. That's a given. And so, yes, the signal is getting weaker. Common sense would dictate you just use more preamplification gain in front of the receiver. Make that weak signal go through a greater number of gain stages, and have the signal become strong enough. Good common sense. There's a little bit of a problem with that one. Let me drop it. And that is, every realistic amplifier will amplify your signal, but it also is going to be generating a little bit of extra noise of the amplifier. How much noise it generates is quantified by something called the amplifier's noise figure. You'd like the noise figure of the amplifier to be lower and lower as you get a signal that's weaker and weaker and you're using more gain. And there's a limit to how far you can go with that. So use state-of-the-art amplifiers at KU band in those days. Well, let me backtrack. You have to first talk to it as the uplink, and even though the satellite is getting further away and the signal getting to the satellite is getting weaker, you can always boost the power on the ground. You can use a bigger dish on the ground, and you can run higher transmit power, and therefore the uplink to the satellite, you can probably keep it working for a long time to come. That usually is not the weak link in the chain. It's the downlink. The 23 watts coming out of that satellite through that 14-foot dish, if it's properly aimed, is getting a signal of finite power output. You're not going to change the power output of the transmitter on the satellite. You're not going to change the size of the dish. You're not going to increase the efficiency of the dish. You've run out of variables. So the signal that the satellite transmits is the best he can do. And now on the ground, the best you can do is make sure that the signal you're listening to is above the noise of your system on the ground. Let me drop. The noise of the system on the ground is a function of the noise figure of the preamplifier on the ground receiver. How big is the dish? How accurately is aimed? Are you aiming into a cold direction of sky? If the satellite is in a friendly location where the sky is not creating a whole lot of noise because of the galactic center and things like that, and I'm pretty sure Voyager is in one of those favorable directions, you got that working for you. But the best you can do, the antenna itself on the ground, the Goldstone dish, it has some side lobes that are looking at hot Earth. The antenna itself is looking at the sky behind Voyager. It's looking at a whole great big chunk of sky, and one little pinpoint of that sky happens to contain the Voyager and the Voyager signal. So the background of free space is 3 degrees Kelvin. That is a certain amount of radio noise. So no matter what you do on the ground, the background radio astronomy or the black body radiation of space is making some noise. That's not the dominant one, but it's one you can't ignore. The dish itself has some side lobes looking at hot Earth in the Mojave Desert of Goldstone, California. Yeah, it is the Mojave Desert. And so if you're real happy, if you've got a very good system, maybe the dish has got a noise temperature of 20 degrees Kelvin. Maybe your Mesa amplifier has got a noise figure, a noise temperature of, let me pick a number, 5 degrees Kelvin. Background body of space, background black body of space, another 3 degrees Kelvin. You add up all of these numbers in degrees Kelvin. And what the bottom line is, there's a certain amount of noise power density coming into your receiver. when you make the receiver more and more narrowband, and there's a lot of ways you can do that. Phase lock repeater, timeout. There's a lot of ways you can do that. Phase lock loop technique, for instance. Let me make sure that the signal, yeah, it is still coming out of the 975-375. There's various ways you can make the receiver more and more narrowband. Every time you halve the bandwidth of the receiver by using a more narrow IF strip on the super heterodyne receiver, for instance, you accept less noise. Once you know the degrees Kelvin of the electronics of your system and the antenna and the background environment the antenna is looking into, that's a certain amount of noise power, and that noise power is rated in power per bandwidth. Quite often the units are dBm per hertz, or dBm per kilohertz, or dBm per megahertz. You define the bandwidth, and you define the noise figure of the receiver, or the noise temperature of the system, degrees Kelvin. Those are almost the exact same phenomena, just two different ways of looking at it. Once you know the noise of the system, you know how much noise power per bandwidth it is creating. Therefore, every time you halve the bandwidth of the receiver, you halve the noise power. And therefore, you would say, gee, let's make it real narrow. Okay, there's a catch. As you make your receiver very narrow, let me take a ridiculous example. If I could make the receiver 1 hertz wide, and you can do that, now your signal is being modulated in some way. It's either phase, it's either angular modulation or amplitude modulation, but there's some kind of modulation of the signal coming from Voyager that you want to receive and decode. Let me drop. No matter what modulation technique you use, phase, frequency, amplitude, digital, whatever, you're going to have the equivalent of a carrier. And depending on the modulation rate, you're going to generate sidebands. If, for instance, right now, for some reason, Voyager wanted to transmit a test code of a 1 kilohertz signal. It wants to transmit a sine wave at 1 kilohertz, as if you're whistling into the mic at 1 kilohertz, for instance. The laws of Fourier series, Fourier transform, spectral analysis, call it whatever you like. The mathematics of transmitting a signal dictates that once you know the modulation rate, you know how broadband the signal is going to be. A 1 kilohertz modulated signal, whether it be narrowband FM, phase modulation, or amplitude modulation, it's going to make at least one sideband 1 kilohertz higher and one sideband 1 kilohertz lower than the carrier. Because you're modulating, you're creating a signal information at a 1 kilohertz rate. In order to get that signal, if it was a simple amplitude modulated signal, and it's a 1 kilohertz test tone that Voyager is sending to you now, and once that signal is modulated onto the carrier and transmitted to you, there's going to be a sideband 1 kilohertz high, 1 kilohertz low. You better have a 2 kilohertz wide bandwidth receiver, or you're not going to get that signal. If you get only the carrier, and it's so narrow that you can't see the upper side lobe, sideband, 1 kilohertz away, and or the lower sideband, 1 kilohertz below, if you don't see the sidebands, you don't get the modulation. You'll get the carrier, you'll know the signal is there, but you won't get the information. The sidebands are where the information is located. So now you're getting a little bit of a clue that what happens. As I make the receiver more narrowband, it can listen to a weaker signal because it's listening to less noise. There's always noise. So you want the receiver to be as narrow as possible. However, make the signal narrow, and now you're limiting the rate at which you can send the information. If I'm transmitting a 100 hertz tone instead of a 1 kilohertz tone, I'm now 10 times more narrow in the transmission bandwidth. So by telling Voyager, by the fact that they designed that system with so much forethought, that they could tell Voyager, okay, you're going to send me some information, but you better slow down because you're getting weak. And you tell Voyager, instead of sending the information the way you used to at 320 bits per second, I want you to now go down one octave and transmit it 160 bits per second. I can now adjust my receiver more narrow, and therefore I can listen to a weaker signal as you get further away. Is this starting to make a little more sense? Here we go. Paul, WS2N, K2IIW in the TechNet.
Looked at the website a while back, and I think they were up to 18 hours. But yeah, that's one way.
So double that to answer Voyager and say, we hear what you're saying.
That has got to be the longest delay line that mankind has ever created in a real medium link. Let me drop. So, you send up a transmitted signal from Goldstone telling Voyager, okay, turn on, listen to the signal, lock onto it, turn on your transmitter, and start talking to us. So, Goldstone starts sending that signal. It takes almost 18 hours to get there. Voyager wakes up immediately, starts talking to you, and the signal from Voyager takes another 18 hours almost to get back to the Earth. 36 hours round trip, day and a half. Boy, that is delay. Wow. And so you tell Voyager, because you're getting weak, you better speak slowly. Start giving me those data bits slower than you did before, 160 bits per second. I can now set my receiver approximately 160 hertz wide. And now, I used to have it 320 hertz wide, but now that I've gone to 160 hertz wide, I'm getting half the noise power because I got half the bandwidth in the receiver. Therefore, I can tolerate a signal that is half the signal strength and still get the right signal-to-noise ratio, the right bit error rate of listening to that digital data. It's going to take you a long time to transmit the data, but at least you're getting the data. And that's by far the longest range piece of electronics or hardware of any kind that mankind has ever issued. And it's one hell of a record-breaking distance. It has now left the solar system. I think the direction of the solar wind, the what used to be called solar wind, I guess is now called galactic wind. It's looking at galactic wind instead of solar wind. The angle of arrival of those wind particles, let me drop on the Voyager detector, the angle of arrival has changed in the last few months, and therefore it crossed the threshold. And my guess is the real heliosphere, in other words, the sphere of this global-shaped object, approximately global-shaped object, which represents the sphere of influence where the solar wind particles go out there and eventually lose their steam and turn around, so to speak. My guess is it's a slightly bumpy object, if you could see it, but at least in the direction of Voyager, the solar wind goes out there approximately 120 astronomical units, and for all practical purposes, it stops. It runs out of steam. And now we're looking at galactic wind. This is my restating of what I think you said, Paul, and you very well did restate what I said to you about the... you can always listen to a signal weaker and weaker as long as the frequency is accurate enough and your receiver is accurate enough in frequency that you set it on the right center frequency, and then you adjust the bandwidth of your receiver to be narrow enough. Well, Voyager always speaks back to you at the right frequency. It has no choice, because it is not generating the frequency it transmits. It is using your signal and turning it around and sending it back to you. Let me drop. The magic of the transponder system, the deep space network transponder system, is it takes your signal, turns it around, and sends it back to you. Therefore, the frequency accuracy is essentially perfect. Your first question is going to be, how in the world can it transmit on the same frequency it receives on without jamming its own receiver? And the answer is, it shifts the frequency by an exact multiple. You could say, and the multiple, by the way, is 240 over 221. Whatever frequency you listen to at Voyager, you could take, you could divide it by 221, then multiply it by 240. So it's listening to 8.2 and transmitting back to 8.3. I'm rounding off the numbers, but you see what I mean. It shifts the frequency by an exact multiple and sends it back to you. It's your own signal shifted in frequency by an exact multiple, by this 240 over 221 ratio. And therefore, you can count all of the bandwidths, all of the individual signals that come back down to be very precise in ranging because of this exact multiple technique. and you have no frequency error problems after you've compensated for Doppler shift, because it's your own signal coming back to you. And once again, make it more narrow, and you can listen to a weaker and weaker signal, and there is essentially no limit. The only real limit comes, let me drop it. If the system would do it, and I don't know, you might eventually get down to 1 bit per second. And now, it's got a whole lot of data to transmit to you, but if it's got to transmit it that slow, you might not have enough goldstone time to listen to the whole message. I mean, you have to dedicate that goldstone dish, aim it in that direction of Voyager for that number of hours to get that signal. And Voyager, and the goldstone dish is used for a whole lot of other missions. So, as Voyager gets too far out, and the data gets so slow, it becomes old news, if you know what I mean. So it's not quite as valuable. For the time being, though, boy, that's a record breaker. That's one heck of a piece of hardware. And how in the world are those inertial wheels lasting that long? What's the magic? We better study that one.
Question, Dick.
In Qtor WSR, clearly on what he said earlier during Space Report.
Okay, so Matt and John in that order. Matt, go ahead.
Okay, I was wondering on this rocket that's supposed to go up again, what day is it and what time, and will it be the same heading 260 degrees?
You got it, Paul.
And also, what will you forget about me?
Okay, yeah, the next rocket that's going to be launched from Wallops Island in Virginia is the Antares Cygnus, Antares rocket with the Cygnus on top. That would be the 18th, so today's the 15th, right? Monday, Tuesday, well, Wednesday. That's 10:50 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. So that's when it would be going, and supposedly, even in the daytime, you could see this thing what you're looking at is the exhaust of this rocket. So it would be probably no higher than 15 degrees. That's, if you take your fist and you hold it out, arm's length, I think that's about 5 degrees, so no higher than 15 degrees if you look to the southwest. And it'll be going into a, I think it's probably 30 degree inclination, but it's going to go up to the south first. Back to you, Dick.
You're saying that that rocket is so bright we can see it in the daytime at 10 in the morning, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, they did with the last launch, when they launched the Antares rocket back in April, that was seen in the daytime. That did not have the Cygnus spacecraft on top. That was the first launch of the Antares. And they just had a dummy spacecraft that weighed about as much as the, or exactly as much as the Cygnus. And had some detectors on board to, make sure everything was okay, and, how it would separate and all the cameras and things like that. But this is the first combination of the Antares rocket with the Cygnus cargo vehicle. But yeah, that's what they say. You can see it here as far as Maine. You can go, but I don't know, very, very low on the horizon, probably a couple of degrees. And of course, if you're down in South Jersey, it's better, and closer you get to the launch site, of course, it gets higher and higher, but it's never going to go higher than, maybe 30 degrees or something, even if you're down there. But if it goes up and then it goes away from you, and then it actually starts to drop below the horizon. So looking at it, it looks like it's going up. And what's it doing now? It's going down. It's going to crash. But it's not. It's going out over the horizon. Back to you, Dick.
Paul, the usual rule of thumb is that a fist held at arm's length, the bottom to the top of your wrist held vertical, is 10 degrees. You can find that out by making the bottom of your fist fall right on the horizon, and then stack the fists on left hand and right hand, one above the other, and you'll realize it takes 9 fists to go from horizon to straight overhead. So each fist is 10 degrees, and there's five fingers in there, so each finger is roughly 2 degrees. So when it comes to measuring those angles, there was another point I was going to ask. I've forgotten it. John, you wanted to ask a question? KC2WGB, I think it was. K2LAW.
Yes, a quick question. When they set up an interferometry range, like they do with some of these large telescopes, and they have maybe six locations throughout the world to get a much better gain, can they also transmit that way if they were all locked in sync?
I think the answer is yes, but I don't think they do it, because rather than try to transmit with two, three, four, five, six dishes simultaneously on Earth, a very difficult problem to make sure you're all in phase. Very difficult. In phase on a rotating Earth. Bad enough to do that on reception, but on transmission. See, in the case of reception, you can have a very precise clock channel on the recording tape, so to speak, with the real data, and now you can search through that tape to find that signal if it's in phase or out of phase. You know how to search through the tape because you've got the timing channel, and you can find the signal. In the case of transmitting, you can't do that. You've got to get it right when you transmit. If there was a frequency error on reception and the tape is probably recorded, you can find the signal and combine it between the various dishes. You can force that. You can force them in phase on reception, even though there was a frequency error in one of your dishes. But on top of that, the easiest way to make your transmitter signal stronger is to use a bigger transmitter. Nothing's stopping you from buying a bigger traveling wave tube with a bigger power supply and connecting it to your dish. That's the easiest way to do it. In the case of reception, if your dish is as big as you can make, and your noise figure of your receiver is as low as you can get, and the side lobes of your dish are as low as you can get, you've run out of options. And in that case, you've got nothing left to do but to use multiple dishes in a long baseline interferometer. So I don't think you're doing it on transmit. Does that make some sense, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick. No, fine answer. I just wondered if they had tried, being that they're tying up one big dish to do this problem. They could move over and try other things. I think Wesley had a question in there. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
One comment for you, John. I did not get that email, by the way, so don't know what happened there on SpaceNet report.
Okay, Paul, thank you.
So once again, that email address for SpaceNet report is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Is that correct, Paul? Go ahead.
USL.
So, you feel a little more comfortable now, the fact that as long as you can force enough frequency accuracy of your receiver, and if you can force enough narrowness to the bandwidth of the receiver, and there's various ways of doing that with phase lock loops and whatever, that now you can always listen to a weaker signal as long as the data rate on that signal is slow enough. Does that make a little more sense now, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yes, and 100%, you explained it very well. And this, I started thinking about this with the test with the Lottie mission, because they're going to be sending, about 1 month from now, they'll be sending laser to Earth and increased data rate of, I think it's 20 meg per second, something like that, a huge number. And yet, at ultra light, the laser is going to be at ultra high frequency. It's going to be ultra. It's way up there, above regular light. And I think it's something like 10 to the 15th. It's like 100,000 times more than what you would get on, let's say, the Ku band. And, you know, what's to stop them? Why can't they go even higher? You know, what's to stop them? I think they're going to stop at 20 to 200 meg per second.
megabits per second. Why can't they go even higher? And maybe in that case it's the electronics. Maybe they can go higher. I don't know. I guess we can talk about this until the cows come home. Back to you, Dick. In the case of a light system, the center of the optical band is approximately 1 million times higher than 600 megahertz. We all have a feeling for what 600 megahertz is like as a radio transmitter. And light, what your eye is operating on, is roughly 1 million times higher than that. That's the good news. And a reasonable size antenna, which might look like a flashlight, is so darn many wavelengths in diameter that it now has a very narrow beamwidth. So laser-like systems at optical frequencies can give you tremendous range. That's the good news. Where is that range coming from? You're not exceeding any of the laws of physics. You're still operating with the inverse square law. Let me drop a call. Every time you double the distance, the signal is going to one quarter the power. You can't stop that from happening. You're not transmitting more power, because you've got a finite amount of power that you can transmit with a laser. Maybe it's a little bit stronger because it's very potent pulses, but still, it isn't the equivalent of megawatts like you get out of a good radar system. You just haven't got that resource on board on the satellite. So you're limited in power. You're limited in bandwidth, depending on signal-to-noise ratio. Make the signal-to-noise ratio high enough, a very strong carrier, or a narrow enough bandwidth of the receiver, you've got good signal-to-noise ratio. You can increase the gain of the antenna, but there's a catch. As the antenna becomes wider and wider in beam widths, in wavelengths, as you use more and more wavelengths for the horn or the parabolic dish, making it bigger and bigger in number of wavelengths. Take the number of wavelengths divided into the magic number 7D, and that tells you the beam width in degrees. A 70 wavelength wide antenna has approximately 1 degree beam width. Well, you can easily get down to milli and micro degrees of beam width with a optical system. But now, if you don't aim it accurately, if you've got an optical system that's a thousandth of a degree wide, you better aim it to an accuracy of a small fraction of a thousandth of a degree. And can your inertial wheels and your other star tracking system get that accuracy? So the light system is capable of a lot of high gain on the transmit because of the wavelength phenomena. But now you've got the corresponding problem. Can you aim it accurately enough? If you've got a tenth of a degree beam width antenna, but you aim it 3 degrees wrong and you miss the Earth, the people down at Gold Zone ain't going to...
Repeater, time out.
Under that condition, the people at Gold Zone are not going to get the signal. My goodness. We got into such fascinating subjects tonight. The time ran away on us. But when it comes to what I think is a little bit of a breakthrough on the potential of solving a problem with digital receivers that everybody in the United States is having, digital television receivers, even though we went way beyond the time when we should have been doing the mailbag and other things, I felt I had to let that one go because I was starting to see some real light at the end of the tunnel. And maybe everybody's not going to agree with me on that one. I can understand that. What you're listening to is TechNet number...
Gentlemen, for another fine net. Much enjoyed up here in Toronto. Z350, that cleared.
If you had a pencil, I just want you to write down this website
that has to do with this company that has been working on that wireless charging technology for the last 6 years in a stealth mode, and now they have finally made it public, and they said they have received about 6 patents on the technology, and they're in final phase of FCC approval. And I wanted you to, I want to get your opinion on it, because I find it to be a little far-fetched, but according to this scientist, he's a physicist that is head of the company that's doing this, he says that it's close to being a viable technology for wireless charging. I just want to get your opinion on it. If you want to write down the name and the company website does not give you any information, but there are videos on the internet, on YouTube, that do give you the information of how the technology is designed, and they're actually using phased arrays, and they're doing it at 2.4 gigahertz, and it's extremely interesting technology, but I question that they can deliver that amount of power. They say they can deliver 1 watt of DC power up to 30 feet from the transmitter with somewhere between 200 and 300 antennas, a phased array of patch antennas at 2.4 gigahertz. It's extremely interesting. I can give you the name and the website if you want to take a look at www.ossiainc.com, and the name of the actual technology is COTA, and if you just go on Google and you search those two words, Ossia Inc. at COTA, and you find these videos, and they give you explanation. They've had some public demonstrations of a prototype of the system already. And basically the way it works is that they take a beacon signal. The receiver on your phone has a beacon that transmits a very low power omnidirectional signal at 2.4 gig. The transmitter picks up this beacon and figures out how to retransmit the high power RF, and by using the direction that the beacon signal came from. So it actually uses multi-path reflections or whatever if there's no line of sight available, and somehow it focuses all the power from the transmitters, like they focus in the phased array system, all in that one point where your phone is. So I would imagine they're creating a very, very high RF field right where your phone is, and if you're wearing the phone on you, I would think that that probably violates the exposure limit in terms of RF field strength at 2.4 gigs. I don't know how they're doing this safely. He was, stressing on the videos that it's done safely, but to get 1 watt at 30 feet away of DC power, I would think you need an extremely high RF field.
Give me that URL again. It sounds like OSSIANC.com, and that wouldn't be Ossia Inc. That would be Ossia NC. Is it OSSIAINC.com? Joe, go ahead.
That's correct, Dick. It's OSSIAINC, Ossia Inc., and the technology is called COTA, CODA. And there's really nothing on their website about it. You have to actually give them your name and information. They will send you information, but there's information existing on the internet. If you look up Ossia Inc. and CODA at the same time in the same search on the same line, you'll find these videos and information about the technology, which I just, briefly described to you. But it seems like it may see some actual commercial applications in the near future. They're saying by about another 2 years or so, it might be ready to be commercially viable. But I question the safety of the amount of RF that this thing has to transmit to supply that much DC power. That far of a distance with RF, because usually a received signal is microwatts, not one watt of received signal. It's an awful lot.
And if you can get 200 to 300 antennas as a phased array, you can generate a lot of directivity. But I know the approximate size of a usual 2 gig antenna, and 200 to 300 of them is a lot of volume. So it sounds like and pushing the laws of physics a little bit, like you're saying, Joe. Thank you, and I'll give that a look. WJ2B, K2RW. Bye-bye for now, and thank you.
Very good, Dick. Maybe if you get a chance to look at it, we can make that a subject.